Back, you and I together again, chatting it up, Monday style, brand new week, March 23rd, 2026, right here on Connecticut Today. We welcome the University of New Haven, Department of Sport, Tourism, and Hospitality, Professor Rob Holub, to chat about the future of the Total Mortgage Arena in the city of Bridgeport. I open the show first wondering if course material from taxpayer-supported state colleges should be exempt from Freedom of Information Commission action and request. And we were joined by CBS News legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum. He explained and talked about a key Mississippi absentee ballot case at the U.S. Supreme Court that could eventually affect Connecticut. All right, got a big arena sitting in downtown Bridgeport now. We just had the announcement last week that we knew was coming for about the last 8 or 9 months, the Bridgeport Sound Tigers, after a nice run, 25 years in the American Hockey League, moving to Hamilton, Ontario. So the big question now is, what happens to the building, what's known now as the Total Mortgage Arena, with the current sponsorship? It opened as the Arena at Harbor Yard, good 25-year-plus run now with the Sound Tigers slash Islanders. But what happens? Here's a gentleman who has some experience with that building, a vast, vast resume, far better resume than me. But that's why I have people like Rob Holub on the show. He's an attorney, adjunct professor, doing numerous things at the University of New Haven with a broad sports background to talk about what's going on. Hey, Rob, it's Paul here at WICC. How are you?
Good, Paul. Thank you for that intro, and thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to have you on because I saw some comments that you had given to Hearst, and I wanted to make sure you got those to my listeners. Interesting stuff. You know, Rob, you look at this building, and you had some association with the building, too. This is a relatively big building. It's not a 4,000 or 5,000-seat barn. It's a 10,000-seat building. So do you think that affords city leaders and regional leaders more possible ways to send the building into a new generation here, a new era?
Yes, I think it does. It's unique because of that size, where it gives it two distinct options. One of the floated options in that article that you spoke about with the CT Hearst was to either break it up into, you know, three potential businesses, with a comedy club discussed, a smaller venue and kind of a medium sized venue, which what you see here in New Haven County, with Toad's Place having two locations, or College Street Music Hall having two locations, and now Westville Music Bowl are options like that. And then the second one is, I think, where the potential lies is it's not as large as a TD Bank, garden up in Boston with 20,000, or a Madison Square Garden, and is not, you know, a 1,000-person facility like those other ones mentioned, where it can get those medium sizes and pull in from that New York, Boston market where people will drive to.
Do you think, though, Rob, looking ahead to any really substantive sports uses for the building, is that done, or do you cut it down and maybe as you make it, as you say, a multi-purpose place, maybe a venue for, a smaller venue for hockey, maybe some area basketball events? Or is a city like Bridgeport, Rob, with 150,000 people, biggest city population-wise in the state, going to be left without a sports venue?
I think the tenant-based sports venue, so what we traditionally know as teams calling a venue and a facility home, is no longer the way things operate, for good or for bad. Mm-hmm. I'll try to keep my personal out of it, but it's kind of always, I use the simple analogy of an apartment, where if you bought an apartment to be a rental property 40 years ago, there was no big feasibility unless you had a full-time tenant paying you rent every month. Mm-hmm. But your expenses kind of keep ticking. You now fast forward to 2026, and if you have an apartment where you can then find a little bit higher of a luxury person to come in, and I'll use the example of an apartment near a wedding venue, and you can generate $1,000 in a weekend, as crazy as that might sound to say, but you can really kind of go high end and get a specific person to come in and say, this is the same price or better than a hotel, and they pay you $1,000, and that's the same amount as a full-time tenant that comes in, you now have that apartment for 3 days in use and 27 days not. And it's similar to sports where a Disney on Ice or a Monster Jam or a WWE, who's obviously still based here in Connecticut, will come in and do extremely well and get 10,000 people, but can't sell out a 20,000 and don't want a 1,000, you know, person facility. And it's kind of what occurs as versus trying to find, you know, people to come 40 times, you know, within a year, especially at 7 o'clock with young families or other things going on, and the capability of watching all of this on our phone now for a small nominal fee.
Yeah, and you're home and you're in your soft, big leather recliner there, and you've got the 48-inch flat screen, which, right, when the arena opened up, Rob, 25 or 26 years ago, wasn't all that accessible price-wise the way it is now.
Correct. And it's always kind of been this in these sports facilities, and we use this term white elephant, which is when a sports facility is built for one purpose and then it's built. And we see this in the Olympics every year, and the World Cup has got a ton of examples. And even here in New Haven, where the tennis facility that now turned into the Westfield Music Bowl, but this opportunity to build something, you spend a lot of money, it looks flashy and nice, and then you chase people to use it. And that's the same with when Harbor Yard and now Total Mortgage Arena, as you said, with the name changes of, you know, we're chasing an AFL team to start, why there was never a center hung scoreboard in that facility. That fell through. They had chased Major League Lacrosse back when the Bridgeport Bluefish were there. They then chased AHL hockey and Fairfield basketball and tried to get Sacred Heart hockey and Sacred Heart basketball. And again, it becomes that we need those full-time tenants. But now you see, is it, you know, on the other end, that expenses where, again, I can use it 3 days a month and just pay people to come in for those 3 days and work. And then the last part of all that is a lot of these, and what you see the current model is at Total Mortgage Arena, is you need a management company, you need a parking company, you need concessions. And then all of a sudden that takes a lot of the profit away if we're not having the building used 300 days a year, as versus one company comes in and says, we can do all this as an event company and spend a little less, but get our maximum revenue for those days because people want to go to Disney on Ice or Bluey or Blippi or any of the kids things that pack out right at the Bushnell and places. But again, people will spend, you know, $500 on a weekend to go see that, but they're not going to spend $500 on a Wednesday, 7 o'clock, you know, for any hockey game or any basketball game for that matter.
Rob Holub is the guest adjunct faculty professor, sports management, and the esports program, too, with our friends at the University of New Haven. Rob, I'm impressed. You started being Charlie the Charger there. You know, I've worn some of those mascot suits. They're not easy, Rob, so high five on you on that. Did you ever think that putting on the Charlie the Charger suit was going to lead to where you are now?
I always say we have great career progression here at the University of New Haven, for anyone listening.
Excellent. Hey, also, you know, when you go back, and it's not all that long ago, Rob, but to 2000, 2001 when the building opened, this really is a generational change, too, as to what's entertainment. I mean, think in the past 25 or 26 years, as hockey teams and basketball teams have battled. With all due respect to these franchises, love them all. I've been involved with sports on the side for years. It was a happening thing to go to a live sporting event 25 years ago, right? When we couldn't sit home and stream 8,000 different movies, TV shows, and documentaries, right?
I agree, and I put it even simpler sometimes to my students and anyone I talk to is it's HD. Even is that we can watch a better product, you know, versus, you know, 30, 40 years ago, or even 20 years ago, where it was really tough to see the puck or any sport, and you didn't have multiple angles, where now you can watch it on your phone and get a much better experience than, unfortunately, sitting in the arenas at this point.
Finally, Rob, so do you think that's the best bet for this arena that you touched on a little earlier? You think it's eventually, for lack of a better term, going to be carved up, sectioned off here? Because I think if they do it right, Rob, the facility can be kind of unique, maybe, huh?
I agree, and I always go back to that Westville Music Bowl example.
Oh, yeah.
And the great people down at, you know, Manic Presents of, you know, they have a super small facility in Hamden, which is a great experience and very cheap tickets, and they have a second venue right across the street, and then they have your medium venue, but then you have your large venue at Westville where, you know, you look last year, it was about 15 concerts that did really, really well. And so, again, if they're continuing to do this into year three and year four, with limited, you know, events going on, there's something behind that idea of just reducing your expenses and being able to kind of elevate your revenue, but still offer a really good product for the community that people will go out and talk highly to. And again, that really awesome part about being in Connecticut, a lot of our venues and a lot of our cities, we can get in and out, and it doesn't take an hour and a half to get to New York City and to deal with 8 million people, yeah, and all that good stuff, where, again, it kind of creates that homeliness where, oh, I saw this awesome, awesome show,
yeah,
and I was back in 20 minutes, which, yeah, is amazing.
That's always good. Rob Holub is the guest. Rob, thanks. Appreciate it. Take care, and we'll chat with you down the road. Appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Appreciate it. Now, either directly or indirectly, I guess we could say directly, although there'd be an argument it goes through channels or whatever, some portion, some relative amount of cents on any dollar that you and I hand over to the great sovereign state of Connecticut goes probably to finance either the University of Connecticut or Charter Oak College or Eastern Connecticut State University, WestCon and Danbury, Southern or Central, the Connecticut college and university system, and of course UConn, which are separate entities. So in a sense, I guess you could say in a roundabout way that we're paying for salaries for teachers, administrators, professors, full professors, associate professors, instructors and residents. You get my gist here. So there's an interesting argument being made at the state capitol that even though you and I aren't there right now, maybe not, you know, working up there, having a role in this, we kind of do. And here's the bottom line of the question that's kind of interesting to me when I look and hear it all this. Question is this. At 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And the argument seems basic at one time, but maybe not. There's a question being floated up at the Capitol right now in a bill that I guess has to move forward by this coming Wednesday. If it doesn't move forward by Wednesday, it probably ain't going to move forward, they say. I guess there's a deadline of Wednesday. Should teachers at Connecticut public colleges and universities be able to keep their course outlines from being made public? Now, I don't know about you. I can't remember the last time I was laying awake in bed at 2 or 3 in the morning staring at the ceiling going, I wonder what some, you know, Western civilization professor is teaching on the store's campus. If they teach Western Civ 101 or 201, whatever, you know what I mean. So in a sense, I don't think it's top of mind on the minds of a lot of people, but it is an important question here, I think. And I wanted to start with this today because it's being deliberated right now. Professors, says here in Paul Yu's story in the Connecticut Insider, professors and other instructors at Connecticut public colleges and universities, so that's UConn, That's Eastern, Western, Central, and Southern Connecticut State. And that's Charter Oak State College. And I don't know if there are any other colleges or schools that, fall under that. They would be allowed to keep their course outlines from being made public under this bill. Now, I got to tell you something. You and I both know 99.999% of people carry the 0.999 even further out. They probably don't really care what's being taught in schools today. But there are some, what would you call them? Rabble-rousers, troublemakers, whatever, who, because somebody is teaching something that has to do with DEI or has to do with Black Lives Matter and all that, they might go up there and say, hey, I don't want my tax money paying for this. And to go back to Paul Yu's story here, the bill in question reflects more concerns inside and outside of academia that individuals and groups opposed to course subjects or the political nature of some research at schools, for example, maybe like UConn, may want to weaponize the open records law and documents obtained through the law. And what do they want to do? They want to harass the faculty. This is what they are saying. This is what the professors' unions and teachers are saying. Now, let me just say this out front. I'm a happy, content, somewhat balding, white suburban, pudgy Italian taxpayer in Connecticut. Frankly, I couldn't care less what they're teaching at UConn if you paid me. That's just me. A lot of people get very passionate when they say, hey, they work for us. Okay, yeah, pal, whatever. I get you. They work for us. I get it. But because you don't agree with something that is being taught on your tax dollar, does that give you the right to get into the records of what a professor is teaching? You see, where's the see, this may be obvious to you and me. Well, I pay for the guy's salary or I pay for the gal's salary. So why don't we just go through with it? Let me see what they're teaching. Yeah. And if you don't like what they're teaching, then what? See, this is the civil libertarian part of me. Is that you don't have to approve of what somebody's teaching to at the same time say, well, you know what, they deserve to have a state salary that may be 1/1,000th of one penny on my taxpayer dollar is going to pay for. The Freedom of Information Commission doesn't like this, the state FOI Commission. They say there is public interest in teaching and conducted at public institutions in the teaching that goes on at public institutions in education, including, as Paul Hughes continues to say here, what's taught and how the instruction is delivered and how students are evaluated. So the State Freedom of Information Commission, which was Connecticut was one of the first people on this here thing, the FOIC arguing access to the course syllabuses, for example, online, ensures the public knows how taxpayer-funded educational programs function and promote transparency. Now, you may say, if you're on the other side of the argument, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, we understand they're getting paid by taxpayers, but does that give taxpayers the right to get a hold of this information and then do whatever with it? Go find where the professor is, pick at the home. I don't know. What do you think on this? And to me, I don't know what the right answer is on this. My rather prodigious gut tells me this should be an open record. But then again, does not the professor, the assistant professor, the full professor, the instructor, you know how they have all these levels of teaching in colleges to go along with the professorial contract there. Don't they have a right, doesn't a man or a woman, professor, instructor, have a right to simply teach the way they want to and to avoid, I don't know, being harassed? You tell me. I'm not sure where I would finally come down on this, but I wanted to put the question out there. We're already getting some responses here. Should teachers who are getting paid taxpayer money at Connecticut public colleges and universities, so we're talking primarily UConn, along with Eastern, Western Connecticut, Charter Oak State College, Southern and Central Connecticut, should they be able to keep their course outlines from the public, even though they're teaching them to hundreds and thousands of happy little college students every year? What do you think? 203-333-9422-333-WICC. So if you're a professor or an instructor or a teacher of some level at, say, one of the state colleges and universities, UConn, Central, Southern, Eastern, WestCon, I think the other one is Charter Oak that falls under the state college and university system. All right. So you're teaching there. So as a teacher, because there's a bill being bandied about in Hartford that would do this, do you want your, I guess they call them their course syllabuses. I looked it up. Is the proper plural there. Do you want anybody and everyone to, I guess, be able to go online and simply take a look at what you are teaching? What the textbooks are? I don't even think they do books anymore. It's all on laptops, but you know what I mean. Shall we say the texts? I don't know whether anybody actually says textbooks or not, but the texts. Should anybody who's not going there, somebody bored like me on a Saturday and Sunday, should I be able to sit there and say, politics 101 at UConn, or the struggle of the American worker 101 at Central or Southern or Eastern or WestCon? And again, these aren't literal. I'm kind of making these up, but there's a point to the madness here. There's another debate going on, and I guess this has come up before, where professors, instructors at colleges in Connecticut say, hey, wait a minute, we want to shield some or all, in some cases, of what we're teaching here to just the regular person who may be bored or, you know, may have political agendas here. You know, there may be somebody who says, well, yes, I refer to DEI, you know, which has become a bad word now, bad acronym here to use. But it could be some professor who says, well, yeah, I use this, but we use it in the course of whatever, XYZ. Should that professor, that man or woman at UConn or at Central or Southern, be able to shield what he or she is doing while teaching? I don't know if the answer is that simple or not. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. You know, some people may hear this, they say, well, that's awfully trivial, Paul. Don't you yourself run your yap 5 days a week complaining about trivial stuff? Yeah, I do. I do. And I say there's some stuff that, you know, maybe should be possibly put on the back burner until we fix the electric grid or try to get taxes down. Yeah, I get that. I'm all right with you saying that. I got you. Gotcha on that one. Got your back. But do you or I or anybody else in this state have the right to know essentially what state employees are doing, especially teaching? Now, some of them will come back and say, hey, Paul, I don't tell you how to prepare for your dopey radio show. I don't tell you what sites to look at. I don't tell you, you know, to look at the Drudge Report or not look at the Drudge Report or look at the Capitol Report or, you know, MS Now? And my retort to that would be, yeah, but I'm not getting paid with tax money. You are. So think about this. I'd love to know what your thought is on this, because I think this is one of those kinds of bills or proposals, right, you hear at the Capitol. And it's, again, it's a good story here. If you subscribe to Hearst, go to the Connecticut Insider, ctinsider.com. This was posted 2 days ago on Saturday, which is why we didn't talk about it last week, because in case you didn't know, I'm not here Saturday. Why Connecticut could shield college course syllabuses from the public. Now, you and I both know that 99.9999 ad nauseum percent people wouldn't care or couldn't care less what was being taught in some. People care about the UConn men and the UConn women in the NCAA tournament. And by the way, congratulations to the UConn men's hockey team. They got into postseason play over the weekend, as did Quinnipiac, Sacred Heart falling a game short. That's what they care about when it comes to UConn, but there are going to be people out there who are going to say, oh, let's see what kind of lefty reading assignments are going on here. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. We're talking about a key case involving the Republican National Committee, I think, the RNC, the state of Mississippi, and something that's been bandied about. When should you have to have a mail-in ballot in to count? Thane Rosenbaum joins us, CBS News. Check out all his books and stuff at ThaneRosenbaum.com. Thane, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Always hearing. Great hearing your voice, buddy. Great hearing you, Paul.
So what were you able to glean, Thane, if anything, today? First, explain the case to my listeners, and what did you glean from the oral arguments here?
So Mississippi passed a law that is now similar to measures that exist in 13 other states. And then there's another 12 states that deal with special rules for expatriates, Americans that are living abroad, or the military. And historically, you know, first of all, historically, Paul, the absentee ballots were for people living out of the country,
yeah,
or serving in the military. This idea of mail-in ballots itself is very new. Historically, you stood outside your precinct with your driver's license and you showed it to them.
Yeah.
That's why in the 2020 election, I guess, yes, 20, mm-hmm, you know, when Donald Trump was claiming fraud, what he was really saying, he obviously believed there was fraud, but what he was really saying is half the country voted by mail. We've never had anything like that. That's because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
States quickly changed their laws literally overnight. Elections commissions did it. Courts did it. State legislatures did it. And all of a sudden, 70 million people were voting by mail. And so his point was, you know, were we ready for something like that to be able to, you know, have the voter integrity on something like that? So the general principle was, under the Constitution's election clause, is that there is a date and that the rules, time, place, and the regulations themselves can be established by state legislatures.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a consensus on a national date of election day.
Mm-hmm.
So the question then, well, what does election constitute? Is it the day or it's when you vote? Right. What's your casting your vote? What is it? When does it count? When you cast it or on the day itself? Because if it's when you cast it, then it doesn't matter when it's received. If there's a law that says you can receive it a week or 2 weeks later, whatever the rule is, depending upon the state.
Yeah.
I fulfilled my franchise the minute I filled out my ballot. I mailed it out. I don't know. As long as it was postmarked or signed before the election date, it's good and it needs to be counted.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is very much part of the polarization of red states and blue states, where there are states that are saying, you know, let's go back to the old school way where you can, you know, clearly verify your identity. Remember, this, all of this has come up in lots of different ways.
Yeah.
Signature verifications, right? there used to be rules like there's an outside envelope and an inside. You got to make sure the is sealed, and then you put the second one needs to be sealed. So the question is, it has much more room for error. It used to be that some of these ballots were rejected because it didn't fulfill a number of the things that were required for mailing in absentee ballots. So Mississippi's just saying, look, you know, let's just make it easier and let's give their sort of an extension when it needs to be received, as long as the vote took place before Election Day. So, you know, the Supreme Court, which is your question, argued the case today. They heard argument today. Clearly, as usual, the three liberal justices felt more strongly that the state of Mississippi had the right to make these laws, to change them to, you know, under the Constitution's Election Clause. Mm-hmm. States can make rules. The Republican National Committee and others challenging the law saying, no, there should be a national consensus. We all do it on the same day. And this just leaves more potential for error. And so we're trying to avoid that. You know, I there was a lot of contention. I'm not sure exactly sure where this is going to end up.
Wow.
But it was an interesting oral argument.
And Thane, finally, you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, the essential argument here, is it not, that we know when the elections are nationally, but states run elections. I mean, I have to explain that to people a lot of times. Well, why can they do this and that? Well, that's kind of the way it's always been.
Yeah, but remember, Paul, in 2020, when this came up with Donald Trump's election fraud claims, his point was, his lawyer's points was that
billable hours. Yes, go ahead.
Billable. The state legislatures are empowered in the Constitution, but not judges and not election commissions.
Okay. Yeah.
So you had a lot of instances. Again, remember, there was chaos in 2000 in that election, right? Remember, we were all like, you know, bundled up waiting for COVID. So every laws were changed in many, many directions. But you're quite right when you tell listeners that the founding fathers left the states the right, the obligation to set time, place, and manner rules, right? Where, what time they're open, right? These polling decisions are made. But then the question would be, you know, what if the rules always required, you know, everything has to take place on Election Day, including the vote, the counting? Because remember, sometimes we don't get the final election results until a couple of days, right?
Yeah.
So there was some argument today. Well, wait a minute. If everything has to be done on Election Day, then everything has to be done on Election Day. So let's be at least consistent. That was an argument that Mississippi was making. We already recognize that everything doesn't have to take place on this day.
Yeah.
And in the era of, you know, where people are home more often in social media, why can't these things either be done electronically or at least what we have now, mail? Why do you have to actually drive to your polling place? And otherwise, if you don't get it in on time, it doesn't get counted.
Well, the only reason I go to my polling place, Thane, you should know this, is for the bake sale that always happens by the front door. I mean, come on, where else am I going to be able to give the Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts $5 for a cupcake? Come on. Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. That, too, resulted once in a Supreme Court case, Paul, because the question is...
Oh, an inducement?
Yes, you can have them, and you can even wear a shirt for your candidate.
Yeah.
But if you work in the polling district, you can't. So if you work, you can't sell cupcakes if you're working as a volunteer. But if you're sort of a church group and you have an opinion who you want to vote for, then you can support it with a sign.
Well, you know, Thane, in the few seconds we have left, there was kind of a kerfluffle here in Connecticut regarding water.
Yes.
Is the water beyond 75 feet away? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And who can distribute it?
I know.
Right. Again, the volunteers versus people that are just happen to be there.
Yeah. Thane Rosenbaum. Check it out, folks. ThaneRosenbaum.com, author of a number of very good books. So check it out. Thane, thanks, man. We appreciate the time,
Paul.
As always. Thank
thanks,
you.
Buddy.
Appreciate that.